So I didn't get a chance to sit down. Mr. Summers made us stand up to sing, but I appreciate the break. You know, it's funny how we experience time. Not ha-ha funny, but at least interesting. Sometimes there's so much happening in our lives that, and time seems to be so crowded that it just goes by so very quickly. At other times, time seems to slow down to a crawl. Sometimes when we have maybe challenging trials, or maybe when we feel lonely, maybe when there's just not a lot going on in our lives. But usually time just seems to go on and on, day after day. Life goes on day after day as time passes. The same routines basically each day. And we get stuck into a pattern or a routine. But then there can be sudden changes and everything from that moment is different. For most of us, most of the time, we do work our way through these patterns and cycles that continually repeat. We actually build our lives on these kinds of patterns, and we anticipate that things are going to continue to be the same as we move on into the future. No one knows the origin of the statement, but I've seen it attributed to a number of writers and even scientists, quoted as saying or discussing the purpose for time. The purpose for time that they describe, it says, they said that time is what keeps everything from happening all at once. So time separates the different events and things that occur in our lives. We were scheduled to have a social tonight, and we hope to have it next week. But the format for that schedule is to look back in time, to consider the decades of the 20th century. We'll have fun laughing at ourselves, remembering the different fashions and hairstyles and music that most of us grew up with. But the passing of time really is a serious thing. And again, as time passes, we generally expect that what we've experienced in the past is going to continue on into the future. Time is very important for us. We keep track of it very carefully. We have our telephones, our watches, and our clocks to remind us what time of day it is. And if we ever get separated from the timepieces, we can become uncomfortable and disoriented pretty quickly. Because what we do and when we do it requires us to know what time it is. Our lives are busy for the most part. We have our plans and our appointments, and people are depending on us to stay on schedule. So we keep our calendars handy, and they help us plan our days and our weeks and our months. Also, as time passes, we have important milestones, birthdays, anniversaries, things that remind us of the passing of years. When we're younger, we're anxious to be older. And by the time we get older, we're anxious because time has gone by so quickly. The title of the sermon this afternoon is It's About Time. God created time. Turn back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 14. Genesis chapter 1, the account of the what we know to be the recreation. We'll drop down to verse 14 in Genesis 1. Verse 13 wrapped up the third day of this creation week. Verse 14, then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years. The firmament of heaven is basically just the sky. It's the expanse that's above the earth where we gaze into. And God defined that part of the earth. He separated it from the earth itself. And then he set in place in the heavens and the skies the signs of for seasons and days and years. God set the clock, and he began measuring time by his establishing of the solar system. The word seasons that's used here in Genesis 1 is translated from a Hebrew word moed, M-O-E-D. That Hebrew word can be translated an appointed time or an appointed meeting. The same word is used in Leviticus 23, where it's translated feasts. For example, Leviticus 23, verse 2 says that these are the feasts of the eternal. The Hebrew word moed is used in that verse. So God set up the solar system to give us a way to keep track of the passing of months and of seasons so that we can observe the annual festivals. He set the clock and the time began. As the earth rotates on its axis, as it also rotates around the sun, we have days and months and years. One of the most important aspects of time is the weekly cycle. Look at Genesis chapter 2, verse 2. It says, on the seventh day, God ended his work, which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work which he had done. One of the most important aspects is this weekly cycle. So here we are this afternoon, thousands of years following creation, observing the very day that God sanctified and set apart. The command to observe the Sabbath helps us to understand the purpose of the day, to honor God and to recognize his plan in our lives. He wants us to be reminded of that every week so that we will always set aside our personal pursuits on the Sabbath to be reminded that God has a purpose for his creation, a purpose for us. And so from creation, God established the time that we keep track of so that we will know when to observe the weekly Sabbath and the annual holy days. There was a feature news story on the Australian ABC network in January of 2022. In that program, a history professor from the University of California, Berkeley, was quoted. He wrote a book titled The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. In his book, he analyzes and tries to figure out why we have a seven-day week. Why do we have a cycle of a seven-day week? In his mind, it's totally illogical. Other units of time, a month, a year, are measurable. We can see the rotation, again, in the solar system. But a seven-day weekly cycle, he says, is completely illogical. The news report, I'll read a small portion from it, says, from the dread of the Sunday blues to the boredom of a Wednesday hump day to the sweet relief of a Friday afternoon, the 7 days of the week govern our lives in countless invisible ways. But while other units of time, it continues, other units of time, like days, months, and years, match the Earth's rhythms, weeks, he says, are much more of a human construction. The author of the book, Dr. David Henkin, says that the weekly cycle, quote, it's the one unit of time that actually is not visibly perceptive in the natural world, and yet it has a real presence in people's lives. Dr. Henkin puzzles over this unnatural cycle that has been unbroken for so long. He claims that the Romans settled on a seven-day week about 2,000 years ago because there are seven celestial bodies that can be seen from the earth. the sun, the moon, and five planets. And they believed that each of these bodies had dominion over one day of the week. That's the best explanation he could come up with for a seven-day weekly cycle. Now, he acknowledges that the Jews were marking the Sabbath every 7 days, and that began a good 1,400 years earlier than the Romans. And he also notes that Christians and Muslims have perpetuated a seven-day weekly cycle, but there's no logical explanation for why we should have a seven-day cycle. But think about it. Even though there have been modifications of the calendar, for example, as we heard in a sermonette a couple of weeks ago, we've transitioned from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar to make some corrections. The weekly cycle was never broken. It was perpetuated. It remained intact. So what Dr. Henkin can't figure out is what is revealed clearly in Scripture. From Genesis, we see that the Sabbath is the anchor of the seven-day week, and it has continued since creation. In his mind, it's an unnatural cycle, but it simply is not. It's not something the Romans made up, but not something that the Jews made up. The seven-day cycle continues because it was established at creation, and it is part of God's law. That seven-day cycle will not be broken. We count on it. We base our lives on it. We also base our lives on other familiar cycles of time. Turn to Genesis chapter 8. Genesis chapter 8. This is after the flood. Noah, it says in the previous, beginning in verse 20, made some offerings to God after the flood had abated and he and his family moved back onto the land. God, at this point, promised that the cycles of the earth would continue uninterrupted from that time forward. Verse 20, Noah built an altar to the Eternal, took every clean animal and every clean animal and bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. It's important, of course, to note in passing that he knew what animals were clean, which would be acceptable to God as a sacrifice. Verse 21, the Eternal smelled a soothing aroma, and the Eternal said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing as I've done. Acknowledging, first of all, human nature that had led up to the flood in the first place, but God promised he would never again destroy the earth in the way that he had at the flood. Then verse 22, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. The patterns of life were established, the seasons of the year were preserved, and God promised that that would be a cycle that would continue from that point forward, and that would never cease. So we count on and base our lives on these familiar cycles of time. Again, here we are in the first few weeks of winter, and it'll be a challenging time of year for us. But in just 8.5 weeks, we'll spin back around, and the spring season will begin. Of course, spring weather doesn't always follow as closely as the spring season does, but we understand that part of the cycle as well. So we go from week to week in our lives. We go from month to month, counting on those cycles to continue. We expect that they will continue uninterrupted, and life will continue as we know it, as we've experienced it. Looking forward to spring, we'll begin to make some plans. There'll be some activities that we're familiar with that will, again, be on our calendars. We'll plan the teen prom. We'll look forward to the spring holy days, the end of the school year, and then the summer season. There'll be graduations, a church picnic, weddings, summer camps, maybe some personal vacation time that we're looking forward to and putting onto our calendars in expectation of this continual passage of time. All along the way, we'll be planning for the Feast of Tabernacles for next fall. And before you know it, the fall season will be over again, and we'll be heading back into winter. Your children will be a year older, and you'll be wondering, where has the time gone? There are other major milestones that we experience along the way. Marriages, the birth of our children, retirement, job changes, sometimes even the death of loved ones. But we're very time-oriented. And as we look ahead, we anticipate and expect life to continue on a linear path, as it always has. But it's important that we not let the patterns of life distract us from what we should be doing with our time and with our life. Let's consider Psalm 90. The 90th Psalm makes some important points about our experience of time. Psalm 90, we'll first of all read verses 1 and 2. It says, Lord, you've been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. This is speaking of the eternity of God. God exists from everlasting to everlasting. God has always been there. His life is eternal. We know that he does not live within time. He stands guard over time and guides the fulfillment of his plan through time. Isaiah 57, verse 15 says that God inhabits eternity. God doesn't live as we do. God lives in a spirit form, and time is not a factor in his existence. To me, God's existence itself is a mystery. It's a mystery to the human mind. Can't really comprehend what it means that God and the Word, as we see in John chapter 1, have always existed from and even before the beginning of what we would say was the start of things. And again, over the course of creating his plan, God includes the creation of time so that he can control those things, events that transpire and that take place. But he himself is not limited by time. Hebrews 9, verse 27, it's a very short and simple and important statement. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27, says, it is appointed for men to die once, but after this is the judgment. So everybody dies. Everybody's life is limited. That's clear from this passage. But it also says that after we die, we give account to God for the way we lived, for the time that we had and what we did with it. Back to Psalm 90, pick it up in verse 7. Psalm 90. Verse 7. Well, verses 3 through 6 first. We see the eternity of God expressed in the first two verses. You turn man to destruction and say, return, O children of men, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it's past, and like a watch in the night. So God, again, lives in a different dimension than we do. He doesn't experience time as we do. And the passing of long periods of time to us really mean nothing to God in terms of his existence. Verse 7 says, we've been consumed by your anger and your wrath, and by your wrath we're terrified. You've set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. For all the days have passed, all our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years with a sigh. Now, back at the beginning of Psalm 90, there's a heading. It's actually a part of Scripture. In our Bibles, it shows it before the first verse. It says here that this is a prayer of Moses, the man of God. This psalm seems to be in the context of Israel's rebellion and their time in the wilderness when they were punished for having rejected God. This happened, of course, because of their lack of faith. They were turned away from the land of promise, and they were sent into the wilderness to wander through the generation and then finally to die. So this passage says that they are consumed by his wrath. Let's compare quickly to Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3, verse 16. Won't read the entire context here, but it's speaking about the time when Israel refused to go into the land, and they first had the opportunity to. We'll drop down into the middle of the context. Verse 16 says, for who, having heard, rebelled? Indeed, was it not all they who came out of Egypt led by Moses? Now with whom was he, God, angry 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? So this we can relate again back to Psalm 90, where it speaks of the people there in this psalm that was written by Moses were consumed by God's anger. They wandered through the wilderness for that period of time because they had been rejected by God and they were not going to be allowed to move into that land of promise. Now drop down to verse 10. It says, for the days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they're 80 years, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off and we fly away. Basically, it's saying, look, life is short and life is difficult. Our life is limited. Based on this statement in verse 10, some question whether this psalm was written by Moses, because of the years that are mentioned here, 70 or 80 years being a lifespan. We know that Moses died at the age of 120, and he was still healthy and strong. You read that in Deuteronomy 34, verses 5 through 7. So how is it that the lifespan here is given as 70 or 80 years? Well, I'm wondering if possibly the 70 to 80 year normal lifespan here might have been the normal lifetime for those who were wandering in the wilderness. They wandered for 40 years, and during those 40 years, an entire generation died off, and a new generation was moving into the land of Israel. So perhaps this 70 to 80 years applied specifically to those who were wandering through the wilderness. But obviously, that period of time has become what we consider a typical lifespan, what we're familiar with. According to statistics that I found, the average age at death in the United States today for men is 73, and for women, it's 81. At any rate, the point of this passage is that our lifetime is brief, and our lifetime is limited. So they wandered through the wilderness, suffering the anger, the wrath of God for their rejection of his promise to bring them safely into the land. Hold your place here and turn to Psalm 103. 103, verse 13. Psalm 103, verse 13. We saw in Psalm 90 that these people were living under in the wrath of God. But the wrath of God is not the way he views all of mankind. We're not all under his anger, his wrath. And we see that here in Psalm 103. Verse 13, as a father pities his children, so the Eternal pities those who fear him. For he knows our frame. He remembers that we're dust. As for man, his days are like grass. As the flower of the field, so he flourishes. For the wind passes over it, and it's gone, and its place remembers it no more. Again, life ends, and it's like we were never there, as in terms of the impact that we have on the earth. So life is something that is brief. We flourish for just a very short time, and then it's gone. But notice verse 17. But the mercy of the Eternal is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him and his righteousness, and fear him and his righteousness to children's children, to generations, to those who keep his covenant and to those who remember his commandments to do them. This is very different from the way that God is described in dealing with people in Psalm 90. So I want to emphasize that in Psalm 90, the anger and the wrath of God was directed at the people of Israel for their rejection and their lack of faith. God is not a harsh God. This is not his view of mankind and not the way he deals with us in general. He pities us and he takes care of those who honor him through obedience to him. Back to Psalm 90, verse 12. So what's the point? What's the lesson that we learn from this experience? From the Israelites who sinned by rejecting God, who wandered in the wilderness and died there, the next generation moved into the land of promise. What's the lesson? Verse 12. So teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. The New Living Translation puts it this way. Teach us to make the most of our time so that we may grow in wisdom. The experience of Israel, all of their history and that we read of in Scripture, teaches us many lessons. Paul emphasizes that in 1 Corinthians 10. There are many passages that emphasize the lessons we can learn from what Israel experienced. The lesson here in verse 12 of Psalm 90 is that we need to be careful about how we live, make the most of the time that we have, so that we may grow in wisdom. We need to remember that our time is limited, and we need to make the most of it that we can. So we need to consider ourselves. Are we making the most of our time? Think back about, for example, the Feast of Tabernacles just 3.5 months ago. When we came home from the Feast of Tabernacles, we probably had in mind a number of things we wanted to focus on. We were inspired and excited and ready to pursue some growth in our lives. We can think about, okay, have I made the most of my time? Or maybe more importantly, we can look ahead. 3.5 months from now, we'll be observing the Passover in the days of unleavened bread. What do we want to accomplish? What kind of personal growth do we want to achieve? What challenges, personal challenges, will we take up in the use of our time over the next few months? It's so easy for time to slip away. We assume that we'll have time to deal with whatever we need to, and sometimes we put it off to another time. But time is what we need to make the best of in our lives. Time is valuable and important and limited. We need to number our days to be reminded and learn to get the most that we can out of our opportunities. James chapter 4. James, the fourth chapter. We'll look at verses 13 through 15. James 4, beginning in verse 13. Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a city and spend a year there and buy and sell and make profit. People make their plans. It's not wrong to make plans, to have an idea of what we want to accomplish. This is talking about on a physical level of making a profit in a business. Nothing wrong with that necessarily. But verse 14 puts it in context. It says, you do not know what will happen tomorrow. We can make plans for a year out in advance, but we're not sure what's going to happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. It's a sobering thought. So instead of, it says in verse 15, instead of making plans that we think we can fulfill, we should leave that in God's hands. If the Lord wills, we'll live and we'll do this, we'll do that. We'll do God's will in our lives as best we know how and best we can. Again, make our plans, think ahead, but we put our trust in God and realize that our plans are not going to be necessarily all that certain. Our time is not going to necessarily unfold the way that we hope or think that it might. It says your life is but a vapor. According to the dictionary, a vapor is a faintly visible suspension of fine particles of matter in the air, like mist or fumes or smoke. Just faintly visible, just barely there. That's what our life is in God's eyes, compared, of course, to his life and what he has to offer to us. But the warning is clear. The warning in Psalm 90, the warning here in James chapter 4, that life is short. We eventually learn that lesson. We eventually learn that life is short. When we're younger, life is all ahead of us. All of our life is ahead of us and in the future, and we see it filled with things that we want to accomplish, things we want to do, things we want to experience. But that perspective changes as we grow older, and soon we're asking ourselves, what just happened? How did I get to be this old? It's a lesson we learn along the way. Probably young people are not in a position yet to understand that, to experience it, because they look ahead. As we grow older, we start to look back, and we start to consider if there's not that much time ahead of us anymore. Our life is but a vapor. Go to Proverbs chapter 19. Proverbs chapter 19. Verse 21 kind of builds on or emphasizes what we saw in James. Proverbs 19, verse 21 says, there are many plans in a man's heart. Nevertheless, the Lord's counsel will stand. As we look ahead to the time of our life, the future, we have our plans. Nothing wrong, as I've said, with having plans, goals, and things we want to experience and accomplish. As long as they're within God's law, there's nothing wrong with that. But we have to remember that ultimately our lives are in God's hands. The New Living Translation puts it this way, says, you can make many plans, but the Lord's purpose will prevail. So we make those plans and we look ahead. Now, having said all this, I don't think that we should look at life in a negative way. We should not look at it as something that's too short and not much is going that we not to be accomplished. But we see it in the right context, that our time is something that God has given to us, and we use it as best we can. We learn from the lessons that we experience in that time, and we continue to devote ourselves to God's way and recognize that He is ultimately in charge of our lives. The patterns have been there, and many of them will continue, of course. But ultimately, and we know that at some point, life itself is going to change. We're warned about serious changes that will take place at the end of the age. And those are things we need to be aware of, because life will be very different. Time will be very different when those things begin to unfold. Turn to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24. Verse 32, I want to quickly compare Matthew 24 with another prophecy. But this is a warning that Jesus gave about being aware of what's happening in the world that we're living in. As we make our plans, as we plan our time, as we anticipate things continuing in our lives, we have this also in mind, to recognize that things can and likely will change. The parable of the fig tree in Matthew 24, verse 32. After having described to answer the disciples' questions, telling them what the end of the age will be like and the signs to be watching for, Jesus gives this parable about a fig tree. It says, when its branches become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So we watch and we see things develop. So you also, when you see these things, know that it is near at the doors. Jesus gave us some information about what the end of the age would be like so that we could be understanding of it, be prepared for it, be watching for it. I want to compare that to what we see in Luke chapter 21. Luke 21 is Luke's account of this same Olivet prophecy that we saw in Matthew 24. Luke 21, verse 29. Luke 21, verse 29, Jesus spoke a parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. When they are already budding, you know for yourselves that summer is near. So it's the same parable that we saw in Matthew 24. In Matthew 24, after this parable about the fig tree, Jesus goes on to illustrate the importance of being watchful and vigilant. He gives a couple of parables about watching and being prepared for Jesus Christ, because we don't know when he will return. There's a different passage that follows here in Luke 21. After the parable about the fig tree, we see verse 34. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly. So Jesus answered the disciples' questions about the signs of the end of the age and of his return. And he said, after giving them that information, he said, look, be careful that you don't let life get in the way of your understanding and you be unprepared for these things when they do happen. He warns us in verse 34 not to get so wrapped up in life that we forget or don't notice what's happening around us. We can look at the words here that are used. They give a pretty clear lesson. Jesus said to take heed. The New King James Version says, be on your guard. And the New International Version says, be careful. Take heed. It's a cautionary warning. The Greek word means to be in a continuous state of readiness to learn of any future danger or need, and to respond appropriately. The key there is to be in a continuous state of readiness, to be on guard, to be careful, to be paying attention to what is happening around us. If we feel secure to the point that we think everything is going to continue to be the same as we've experienced in the past, then we can lose our focus. We can begin to drift in the way that we live. Take heed, be cautious, be aware, recognize that things will not always continue to be the same. Take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down. The phrase weighed down means to be heavy or a burden. Life can become a burden. Life can become complicated unless we are being careful, living properly, living carefully in our lives. The consequences of sin complicate life. We don't need the extra burden that we put on ourselves by not being careful about the way that we live. Take heed to yourselves that your hearts be weighed down with carousing and drunkenness. The word carousing in the Greek means to live without moral restraint, without care or thought for what is right or wrong. Sometimes people drift enough away from the warning that Jesus gave that their life just becomes something that is not worth following and acknowledging Jesus Christ and his instructions. Be careful. He's speaking to his disciples. He's speaking to people who have understanding, but he's giving us a very simple, important warning. Be careful. Be careful the way you live. Be careful how you use your time. Weighed down with carousing and drunkenness and the cares of this life. The cares of this life can have a couple of different applications. Certainly they can be the struggles and difficulties of life. We have things that we are burdened with that are trials, that are challenges. But we should be careful that they don't become something that distracts us from the understanding that Jesus is explaining here. Cares of this life can also be the deceitfulness of riches, as Jesus expresses in Matthew 13, verse 22. Cares of this life, things that distract us. He warns in many passages about physical wealth. Physical wealth is a lie. Devoting ourselves to those kinds of cares and priorities will simply weaken us. God blesses us in many ways, but if those blessings and those comforts become the goal or the purpose or the focus of our lives, then we weaken ourselves and we won't necessarily be ready to recognize when times are changing. So in verse 35, he says, watch out. This is the New Living Translation. It says, watch out. Don't let your hearts be dulled by carousing, drunkenness, and the worries of this life. Don't let that day catch you unaware like a trap. For that day will come upon everyone living on the earth. At the end of this age, everyone will be affected by the events that unfold. We can be prepared for those by using our life and our time carefully and recognizing the challenges that we do know eventually are going to come. So in verse 36, he says, watch. So be vigilant, be awake, be alert. Watch and pray always. Watch and pray always. That's the key to maintaining our awareness, to staying focused as life and time continue. Watch and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things. Interesting that the word worthy could be defined as being strong. The Greek actually reads that you may be strong enough to escape all these things. Strength comes as we are focused on and continuing in what we have been warned about and recognizing it and not letting life or time be distracted by by other priorities. So the warning is that while everything else seems to be the same, everything seems to be normal, those caught up in the routine of life and the passing of time may be caught unaware of what events are going to transpire in the future. Paul repeats the same message in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. verse 1, it says, "Concerning the times and seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you." Why? Because we take heed. Because as Jesus said in Luke 21, verse 34, we're watching. Comparing it to that, or considering the parable, we're watching the fig tree. We're watching the events that are taking place. We recognize that as time passes, things are changing. And we understand the significance of changes that are taking place. We're keeping track of the times and the seasons by taking heed, by being watchful, by being on guard. Matthew 24, verse 37 warned of those who are oblivious, who will be living as if everything is the same as it always has been. Matthew 24, 37 talks about how the people were living in the normal lives, marrying, giving in marriage, not knowing what was about to happen. Things were continuing as they always had. The plans for their lives didn't take into account the fact that the point that things can change, and they were unaware of it. Again, 1 Thessalonians, continuing in verse 4. First Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 4. "But you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light and sons of the day. We're not of the night, we're not of darkness. Let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober. For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk at night. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love. Because God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through Jesus Christ." So we live in the light of day. We remain vigilant and alert. And in doing so, we are protected by faith and by the hope of salvation. So it comes down to a question of what priorities we have in our life and how we use our time, how we live from day to day, how we understand and look to the future through Scripture and through the warnings that Jesus has given us. So let's look at one last verse in Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13. Verse 11. Romans chapter 13, verse 11. Says, "And do this, knowing the time." Do what we do, and verse 13 is giving us basic Christian principles to live by. And so he comes to the conclusion of this portion of the Scripture, this passage. And Paul says, "Do this, knowing the time." Consider the time in which we live. Consider the circumstances in which we live. Consider the passing of time and what we look forward to and what we know will happen in the future and what we anticipate happening in our lives. Know the time. Know that it is high time to awake out of sleep, for now our salvation is nearer than when we first believed. The phrase "high time" means something that it refers to something that should be done, that should have been done already. It's high time. It's past the time when something should have already been done. So Paul is warning that we just don't have a lot of time. That we need, these are some things that we need to be urgent about and to be aware of, recognizing that we don't have any time to waste. It's high time to awake out of sleep, to not be spiritually lethargic. Our salvation is nearer than we first believed. We certainly, with each passing day and month and year, we're that much closer to that time when Jesus Christ will return. We're closer now than we ever have been to the time when Jesus Christ will hold us accountable. Paul wrote in Ephesians 5 that we need to redeem the time. To redeem the time means to, the word Greek word translated redeem means to rescue from loss, to take, to bring it back, to get it back. The Lowenida lexicon says it means to take full advantage or make the best use of time, which we saw earlier. We redeem the time. We recognize that it's high time. There's no time to be left to be wasted any longer. We need to be focused on what the important thing is for us to be prepared for, to use our time wisely. Continuing in verse 13, we talked about putting off the works of darkness, put on the armor of light, and walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness or lust. So the way we live, the use of our life, the use of our time, is something that is critically important, and especially as we consider the times that we live in. It is, as Paul puts it, and if he wrote this almost 2,000 years ago, how much more urgent is it now for us to hear this message? So we know that it's easy to be distracted. It's easy to go through time, to make our plans, to live our lives from our vantage point, from day to day, from week to week, month to month, not necessarily always keeping in mind that the passing of time is something that is very important for us to recognize. Scripture has a lot to say about our awareness of and our use of our time. Time is our life. Time is an invaluable resource, but it's a resource that is limited, as well as being critically important that we not be distracted from how we should use the time that God has given to us. So when we think about how we spend our life, it's all about time.